Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. My name is Stan Berman of the law firm of Heller Ehrman, and I represent Pacific Gas and Electric Company, or PG&E. From November 2000 through June 2001, the California Independent System Operator, or ISO, properly billed its customers under its tariff, under the Neutrality Adjustment Clause of its tariff, Section 11.2.9, for over $100 million in costs associated with energy exchange transactions entered into during that period. Sometime after those transactions were over, in August 2001, the California ISO had second thoughts about the way that it billed those charges to its customers. The ISO made a filing at FERC in August 2001, after all the transactions were over, to explain its new methodology for billing the costs. And FERC put out an order October 17, 2001, addressing the ISO filing.
Now, so an amateur like me can follow you along. When you say they made the filing, are you talking about Amendment 51?
No, Your Honor.
Yeah. So tell us what you're talking about as you go along, just for those of us who are new to this game.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The issue here is whether the California ISO engaged in retroactive rate making when it filed Tariff Amendment 51.
That might be the substantive issue, but I thought the main issue was whether this is a collateral attack, and so whether we should reach the merits or not. Isn't that the underlying main issue?
Your Honor, you're correct. That's the main issue raised by FERC, and also an issue raised by the ISO, is the issue of collateral attack, which is why I referred to the August 2001 filing. That's because the August 2001 filing was in docket ER01-2886. That is the seminal case that FERC and the ISO cite to for the proposition that we're collaterally attacking prior FERC orders.
Okay, so now you're referring to the August 2001? Is that what you said?
The filing was made in August 2001, and FERC ruled on it October
17, 2001. Okay, so it's October 2001 order. That's the first order you're talking about. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll note that FERC then cites several other orders that it says that we're collaterally attacking. But in general, those other orders cite back to the October 17, 2001 order. Because in those orders, like in the orders in the Amendment 51 case, FERC did not address the substance, but said we were collaterally attacking the prior order or referred back to the prior order that was entered October 17, 2001. That's why I believe that all the answers to this case can be found if we look at the order that was entered October 17, 2001, which I've enlarged right here. I believe that we'll find that when we look at that order, which is the root of everything that FERC and the ISO argue, you'll see that, in fact, PG&E is correct and that we're not collaterally attacking that order.
I have a question. Now, you have the neutrality adjustment charge, and then it was changed to the the negative uninstructed imbalance energy, correct?
Yes.
Total negative uninstructed. Now, the neutrality adjustment charge was a disadvantage to the person that caused to have to get power, then it was returned later in like two times the amount, correct? And so it ended up as penalizing the parties in the return period that may have had nothing to do with the need initially, correct?
The Your Honor, I would say that the neutrality adjustment charge spreads evenly over the market the costs of the transaction.
All right, but the argument is that if you were a person that had nothing to do with the power being needed, you would say, well, I'm having to pay for something that I wasn't the cause of, right?
That's an argument that might have been made, and I think that's the reason the ISO decided after the fact retroactively to change their methodology.
Well, because just so that I understand the context of this, now, I noticed at a couple of different places in in all the documents that I have. PG&E was claiming it was worth $80 to $100 million, and another place $100 to $200 million. Since the change went from the neutrality adjustment charge, which I'm assuming PG&E considered that was a favorable way to PG&E, am I correct in assuming that PG&E was responsible for more of the power needs than some other people that are involved here?
Under the bogus auction results from this period, PG&E was found to be responsible. But the auction results that led to that were bogus, and FERC has found that because the auction results, which decided whether you bought power in the PX forward market or the ISO real-time market, FERC has found in the refund proceeding that Judge Thomas is very familiar with, that those auction results were based on unreasonable prices during the period at issue here. So to say that any particular party was responsible for the charges or was the one who should have been buying the power in one market versus another market is to accept the auction results that FERC has found to be unreasonable. So I would say, Your Honor, no, it's not reasonable to conclude that PG&E, more than any other market participant, was responsible for the charges that were incurred.
Mr. Berman, just you start out by referring to this October 17 order, and I guess you've given us copies of it as well as put on the board, but this refers only to the BPA agreement, right? And I assume you're going to take us through how this came to apply more generally.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the issue is that when the ISO came up with its new methodology, it filed the BPA agreement, which doesn't reference the new methodology, but in the cover letter in which it submitted the filing, it referenced the new methodology. So then FERC put out an order, and in the order, as you can see, FERC accepted the agreement, but it doesn't reference the change in methodology that was referenced in the cover letter. To the contrary,
give us the name of the new methodology.
The new methodology is the imbalance energy methodology or the uninstructed deviation methodology. Judge Callahan gave another name. I don't know that.
Negative uninstructed imbalance methodology or whatever, but we're talking the same thing.
It's something
right?
different than the neutrality charge. And what you'll note is that in the October 17th order, when FERC was ruling on this filing by the ISO, where the ISO mentioned its proposed change in the cover letter, FERC noted the way the charge was assessed to customers, and FERC said the ISO recovers costs associated with these transactions under its neutrality adjustment charge mechanism. It doesn't propose – this order does not accept a change to the methodology. It instead accepts only the agreement with BPA. And the agreement with BPA was proposed to be effective January 2001, whereas the change in methodology was effective November 2000. But this says it goes back to January 2001. I also note that on the second page of the order, the FERC specifically says that it's not approving any change in rate charge classification, and makes clear that they're not accepting a change to the ISO tariff. They're simply adopting the mechanism that was already in place. The mechanism that was already in place is the neutrality adjustment charge method. I submit that if you look at the refund proceeding and the orders that FERC cites to say that they've already decided this in the refund proceeding, what you'll find, if you look at, for example, paragraph 536 of the December 12th order, is that there the presiding administrative law judge said that the methodology to be applied to energy exchanges is the methodology that was adopted in docket ER012886, which is this order. Then in the October 16, 2003 order, footnote 17. Footnote 17, which is the order on rehearing in the refund case.
Is that the ALJ order?
That's the order on rehearing where the commission was reviewing the ALJ order.
All right.
In that case, the commission clarified or repeated that it was adopting the methodology accepted in ER012886. But when you look at docket ER012886, the only order that was issued in that case was this letter order, which applies to the neutrality adjustment charge mechanism. It does not, again, does not accept any change to the methodology. And really, that's our case. We're relying on the neutrality adjustment charge mechanism. Every argument they make claims that it was changed in this case.
So you filed for a reconsideration of a certain order, right? Is that right?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand the question, because we've filed for reconsideration of orders in the Amendment 51 case.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, I'm not using the right phraseology, but all right. So when did it first? Your claim is that this change in methodology first came to your attention when?
This order didn't put anything to our attention, because this order says that they're going to use the methodology that we want,
right,
the neutrality adjustment charge methodology. It was during the refund case in discovery that we learned that the ISO intended to use a different methodology. We sought clarification of that with the presiding judge, and the presiding judge said in its order, without addressing the substance, we should use the methodology spelled out in this order. Then we sought rehearing, and the commission said, use the methodology that was spelled out in this order. Then the ISO filed Tariff Amendment 51, filing a tariff amendment proposing to change the methodology to the methodology it wants to use now, not the neutrality adjustment charge. We complained and said they should be using the neutrality adjustment charge. And FERC said in response, we've already ruled against you.
So is it your position that the first notice you had of this new methodology was the proposed Amendment 51?
Your Honor, in the refund proceeding, we came to understand
through some discovery, you learned somebody was using or contending they could use this different methodology.
Through discovery in the refund proceeding, we learned.
What did you discover? Correspondence? Or an order of the commission, or what did you discover?
We discovered through discovery requests to understand the way the ISO was doing its charging out various costs during the for its refund calculations. It wasn't doing anything with the energy exchange costs.
Let me ask the question differently. When did you first find out that some people took the position that this new methodology had already been authorized by the commission?
I believe that in the refund proceeding, the ISO made the argument that it had been previously authorized in this docket. We said, that's ridiculous. This docket approved our methodology, not theirs. The commission in its orders never addressed the substance and simply referred back to this docket. Every order that is cited to, if you read the orders, every order simply cites back to this docket and says that it's using this. I'll note that the refund proceeding was not final. In fact, was pending on rehearing in those orders while the Tariff Amendment 51 proceeding was filed.
So what are you challenging in your other Ninth Circuit case?
Well, in the other Ninth Circuit case, Your Honor, we've briefed and have argued a different issue relating to energy exchanges, which is that FERC did not order the energy exchanges to be mitigated, and we've argued that the energy exchanges should be mitigated. If we were to prevail on that, that would substantially reduce the number of dollars that have to be assessed to customers here, because instead of a lot of dollars, they would be mitigated back down to reasonable levels. Right now, the energy exchanges, unlike other energy charges, are being charged at the inflated prices of the period rather than at the lower prices that FERC later found to be just and reasonable.
So this isn't just a second bite at the apple?
Your Honor, this is not just a second bite at the apple, among other things, because it wasn't until this case that the ISO included this proposed change in the tariff amendment. This is Tariff Amendment 51. The ISO, for some reason, thought it needed to file a tariff amendment in 51 to address this change, and I believe it's because of the ambiguity of the prior orders that simply refer back, the refund proceeding refers back to this order, that this order meaning the October 17, 2001 order. And the October 17, 2001 order merely adopts the old methodology that PG&E wants us to adopt.
Why couldn't you have raised this new methodology issue in the refund proceeding?
Your Honor, quite frankly, we tried to, and in response, the commission responded
that the commission responded, but its response was that it would not look at the substance. It said, we already addressed this in docket ER-12086. We're not going to look at it again. We're going to use the ER-12086 methodology.
And that's not an order?
2886.
That's not an order from which you could have petitioned for review?
Your Honor, we were able to petition for review from the October 16, 2003 order, which came out after Amendment 51 was filed and after we had filed our protests of Amendment 51. I would note that if you think that there's some confusion as to which case we should be pursuing this in, that's not a reason to dismiss our case. We shouldn't be whipsawed about by finding that we cannot raise the argument anywhere. At the very least, you should simply hold the matter in abeyance in one of the proceedings so that we can pursue our issues somewhere, because somewhere we deserve the right to argue that this letter order actually adopts our methodology and is flatly inconsistent with the claim that that some different methodology should be used.
Well, you deserve that opportunity only if you haven't had that opportunity earlier, right? I mean, that's this case, I assume.
But, well, I believe that this is the right case to raise the issue in, Your Honor, because this is the case where the ISO filed the tariff amendments seeking to make the change and where it was appropriate for us to say it's illegal retroactive rate making because the change was made after the time the service was taken.
Very good. Any further questions?
Your Honor, I note that I appear to have...
We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, I'm Michael Ward of the law firm Alston & Byrd in Washington, D.C. I represent the California Independent System Operator Corporation, also known as the ISO. In addition to answering any questions you have at this time, I'd like to spend my time briefly just to review the circumstances that gave rise to the Commission's orders under review, the defects of those orders, and the inadequacy of the Commission's response before this Court. This proceeding arises from an order of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission prohibiting the ISO, under the terms of its tariff, from recovering costs that were incorrectly paid to generators for services that the generators have not actually provided. As you're aware, the ISO administers the majority of the transmission system in California. As part of that responsibility, it needs to keep maintain the reliability of the transmission system. And in order to maintain that reliability, it has to be able to increase the generation of electricity in a matter of seconds often. For example, if a generator or a major transmission line fails, the ISO must immediately replace the electricity that was provided by that generator or through that transmission line. In order to keep that ability, the ISO makes arrangements with generators to maintain a certain portion of their energy capacity unloaded, available as reserves to the ISO in the event of an emergency. These reserves are called ancillary services, and the ISO procures the ancillary services through its auction markets. Of course, for the capacity to be useful to the ISO, it must remain unloaded or unused. The ISO tariff has always required that ancillary services be available when called upon, that they be unloaded in order to be paid for. Fortunately, from 1998 to 2000, a number of generators sold ancillary service to the ISO and then turned around and generated electricity from that same capacity which they sold in the ISO's markets. Because the ISO's settlement process was automated, those generators were actually paid for that ancillary services that they didn't deliver. Under the ISO tariff, however, the ISO has the ability, and it has always had the ability, to rerun its markets to correct errors. When the ISO determined that the generators had been paid for ancillary services that they had not, in fact, provided, the ISO determined that it was going to rerun its markets to recover those payments. The tariff does not require that the ISO seek permission from FERC in order to rerun its markets. The Commission orders in question here arise, as you're aware, from Amendment 51 to the ISO tariff, which the ISO simply proposed to modify the invoicing process for its settlement reruns. the ISO in filing Amendment 51 did not ask the commission to do anything except to approve its modified invoicing process. The commission did, in fact, approve that process, but didn't stop there. Following the approval of the amendment, the commission issued orders that prohibited the ISO from conducting certain refunds. And I'd like to repeat that this authority to conduct refunds existed before Amendment 51 to the ISO tariff and was not dependent upon commission permission. In preventing a rerun, the commission stated that the issues raised by Amendment 51 and by the rerun were being addressed in its own investigation into gaming. In fact, the issues were different. The ISO explained that to the commission in its request for rehearing. Yet, in denying rehearing, the commission merely stated the ISO was attempting to expand its investigation into gaming. The commission never addressed the ISO's arguments, and as a result, I can't explain to you today the errors in their reasoning, and you have no ability to examine them because the explanation is not there.
All right, but the question in this case is, should we examine it, right?
That's what I was shortly turning to, Your Honor, which now, not having explained it and left you without the ability to understand their arguments, the commission tells you they can't review the explanation because their hearing, their order, which denied the ISO's authority under the ISO's tariff, its pre-existing authority, was a decision not to institute enforcement action. The error is there is that the ISO never requested that the commission institute enforcement action. ISO did not need the commission's authority to institute enforcement action.
This was a authority includes
the authority to investigate.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we did not ask the commission to investigate. ISO had already conducted its investigation and would have proceeded under its tariff authority to recover these payments. It did not need the commission to conduct any investigations or to take any action in order to conduct these reruns. So the ISO simply filed a very limited tariff amendment to revise its invoicing process. The commission's attempt to use this proceeding to limit the ISO's tariff authority is not only unexplained, but it's unauthorized because it went beyond the scope of the proceeding. As a result, the commission's order is both beyond its authority and arbitrary and capricious and must be reversed. I will reserve the remainder of my time unless you have additional questions. And also, if you have any questions about our intervener's brief, that's not what I'm here for, but I certainly will answer them.
I do have one question. If you were permitted to proceed, then wouldn't the affected entities they could protest the rescission by filing complaints with the commission, leading inevitably to expenditure of commission resources?
They could, Your Honor, if they indeed felt that the recovery was incorrect. But since the recovery occurred in the ISO tariff, I don't think that it's appropriate to reject the ISO's ability to operate under its tariff because of the potential the ISO's authority might be later challenged.
Well, doesn't the commission have a right to make some sort of decision about how they want to spend their resources?
The decision was not yet before the commission. You know, it did not even know. It's purely hypothetical. The commission had no idea what it was doing in terms of expending its resources. If I can use an analogy, Your Honor, if I am charged by a merchant on my credit card for goods that the merchant can't deliver and doesn't deliver, the credit card company is entitled to and should make adjustments to my credit card bill and my billing, regardless of whether the government decides to pursue the matter as a fraudulent effort on the part of the merchant. That's what we have here. The ISO was simply operating to correct the billing statements under its own tariff.
All right, but then all the disputes to that would go to the commission, right?
In the same way, any disputes under a credit card company's operations would go
to
the
court. So they wouldn't have a right to say, no, you know, we're handling this whole energy crisis situation and we don't want to spend our resources dealing with that.
These weren't even energy crisis circumstances. These were tariff violations that occurred prior to the energy crisis from 98 to 2000 that the commission never even examined in deciding to issue the show cause order. The commission's staff report on the show cause order just started looking at January 1st, 2000 forward. So the commission actually had never even considered these orders.
Very good.
Thank you.
Your Honors, my name is Patrick Lee. I'm here for the commission. And this case basically concerns a couple of orders and a multiple number of orders and proceedings that were before FERC. Now, despite the fact that petitioners want to make it seem like it's a very overly complicated, I mean, it is an overly complicated situation, but it's the facts that they're presenting are a very limited version of it. First, I would like to address the CAISO's issue regarding the Heckler v. Cheney situation here. As Judge Callahan, you just mentioned, it ultimately this decision is a determination of whether or not there was a violation of the double selling by marketers and generators. In FERC's Enron show cause proceeding, and it was not just about Enron but various other entities, the commission determined that there were four entities after evaluating mountains of evidence and basically determined that there were four entities that it felt should be disgorging its unjust profits for the double selling. It made a determination that it would marshal its limited resources and address those parties and those parties only.
When you say address it, you mean by instituting some kind of proceeding?
The proceeding was underway, and the proceeding is still continuing. So the commission determined that that was a gaming violation. It specifically determined that there was a violation of the basically of the MMIP and the tariff there. So the CAISO's the CAISO is basically making it seem like this is some sort of Scrivener's error in which they could just willy-nilly flip a switch and voila, they can correct everything. It's actually, the FERC has to make its determination whether or not there was a violation and whether it wants to spend its limited resources and enforce these violations. Now, in the show cost proceedings on the double ancillary sales, it spent its limited resources and determined that it would only focus on a specific time period, which was January 2000 to June 20th, 2001.
But ISO's argument is somewhat different. I don't think they're arguing you don't have the authority to prosecute when you choose to prosecute or try to limit your enforcement. What their argument is that we never ask for enforcement. We can make those determinations, and there's a remedy through FERC if we make them incorrectly.
No, I would disagree, Your Honor. I think that what they're basically trying to do an in-run, a learn-around on it. And if they could do this on their own, they would have done it, but they haven't done it. So the whole fact that they say that they have this authority, but they haven't done it, leads one to think they have to come to FERC and get FERC's authority as to whether or not there was a double sale violation. It's not.
No, I understand they haven't acted yet, but they've shifted their argument a bit, and I understand it's a slightly different argument than historically, perhaps.
And Judge Callahan and Judge Thomas, you just mentioned that the entities that would be found to have violated or done this double sale would then come to the commission and request file a complaint against these entities. The commission would then be determining whether or not there had been a violation of the tariff and whether there had been a double sale of ancillary services. So at its core, the whole issue is about whether or not FERC is going to enforce, spend its limited resources and investigate and enforce whether or not there had been a violation of the tariff and the FPA.
So your argument is you can't really correct the errors without investigating to see if
right. There's
been a double selling, and the investigation or the prosecution part of it is FERC,
And FERC has decided that it's going to put its limited resources and concentrate it on certain marketers and generators. There are four of them that it specifically found that should be the ones targeted. And that
but now Cal ISO wants to do it because then they could get some money. They could get some more money, and then if the people contested it, then FERC would have to deal with
it. Cal ISO believes it's got some sort of authority to do it, but the thing is the Cal ISO has to the FERC has to determine whether or not there had been a violation of the double sale. It's not as if there has to be a determination, essentially, by FERC whether or not there had been.
Are you really saying, or are you agreeing with them, that they could go ahead and do something and file, even though you've taken the position you're not going to prosecute, you're not going to investigate, you're not going to find any violation?
I don't believe that.
Do you think today that Cal ISO could go out and say, all right, now we're going to make these tariff adjustments, and if the affected parties want to, if we want to litigate and work with him. Is that what you're saying?
I can't make any, that would be post hoc rationalizing on my part. And since I would say that what it is they're encroaching upon first.
Well, is there any easy place to look to say who has the authority to do that?
Well,
are we back into that? FERC makes the interpretation of who has the authority to do it, and FERC is entitled to deference.
FERC is entitled to deference on
is that how we're
on its orders and on also tariff filings.
Well, then the question is on whether FERC gets to co-opt every other procedure by deciding it's going to initiate a show cause or enforcement action.
But that's because FERC is the enforcement authority here. It's not the ISO. Now, and under the FPA, Section 307, FERC has discretion as to whether or not on its investigations.
Yes, sir.
So,
but they aren't quarreling with your discretion. They just said that their argument today is that they have the authority to act despite that, and then you have the authority to review that. Your arguments today are passing in the night.
Well, but the thing is that what they're saying inherently gets to FERC's domain of enforcement authority, and FERC has already determined that.
Right. If you don't think they should, if you don't think they have the authority to do it, you should just say so. You're basically saying, well, they haven't done it. It's an end around. We have discretion. If your position really is that they don't have the authority to do what they propose to do today, which is to go and adjust the tariffs on their own, you should just say that. Is that FERC's position or not?
Well, FERC's position is stated in its order, and FERC's position there is one was that it was a basically.
Also, that there was another proceeding that's the Enron show cause proceedings that governed this.
Right.
And that it is we have a situation of Heckler v. Cheney arising here, and that it's that FERC's discretionary enforcement authority is being prescribed here. Now, the other point is that this is essentially a collateral attack on those Enron show cause orders about the double ancillary sales. So, that beyond that, I mean, our brief basically goes with the essential argument is that it's a Heckler v. Cheney situation here. No.
Better turn to PG&E.
Yes. With PG&E, the issue is there are many proceedings going on here, but it's at its heart it is a collateral attack, and it's very simple. We don't have to worry about the retroactive rate making, the notice issues at all, because it's the collateral attack situation that we should look at. Now,
they showed this EPA adjustment order and talked about the neutrality adjustment charge mechanism being the one that's actually being enforced.
Now, the filing in the BPA filing clearly indicated that the negative imbalance, the CT-1487 mechanism, that's what it is the one that is being implemented. Now, FERC's order in ERO 2886 approved that mechanism. Then in the California refund proceeding,
so these are not quite the same in the California refund proceeding. You have to deal with that.
Well,
we're talking about mitigation measures in the California refund proceeding.
Mitigation measures was an issue. Now, but the thing is, in the underlying, in the FERC proceeding, in that docket,
They specifically, the California parties in their request for a rehearing, raised the issue of cost allocation in 1487 and CT 1487. The format in which that they're objecting to right now, that was specifically raised in the request for a rehearing, and they, whether, you know, the fact that they may or may not have raised that on their petition for review in the proceeding that is currently before the court in the other case, that was their, you know, that was their problem. They failed to make their argument.
I mean, basically what you're saying is that was the, your argument apparently is that they needed to do it in the refund proceeding. They didn't do it. They waived it. They can't do it here. Is that what you're saying? Because then, in fact, they don't have an opportunity to litigate this on the merits ever.
That's because they failed to raise the, to seek petition for review then. I mean, that's, I'm not here to be their attorneys. It's, they make them, they fail to.
I'm just asking for your position, not to.
Well, that would be the collateral attack, that they fail to address that issue in their prior proceeding. In the refund proceeding, it's clear that they raised the issue. In the request for a hearing before the commission, they specifically mentioned the CT 1487 method, and they had problems with the allocation of costs, the accounting methodology. The commission said that the accounting methodology is the one that we're going to approve in the BPA filing. The BPA filing was about the CT 1487 issue. They didn't do anything about it.
I think the difficulty with your argument on that, though, is that, of course, they wanted to preserve the rights they had. It doesn't necessarily mean they thought that was the exclusive right. And at the same time, FERC was telling that PG&E had to go, that it really ought to litigate somewhere else, that this was another order that related. I mean, I recall that. Well, so you can't keep this. You can't do a show game on these parties prevent them from having a petition for review.
I would say it's not a show game, because the thing is, they specifically raised it in their request for a hearing, which was April 25th, 2003, when they filed it. Now, the rehearing order in the refund proceeding came out on October 16th, 2003. Their petitions for review, I believe in this case, I mean, the first order in this case that really, not the June order, but the November 13th, 2003 initial order in this specific case saying that we're going with the accounting methodology, now that was subsequent to the refund proceeding. So clearly they had enough time. They were in the refund proceeding, and then they basically abdicated their rights there, and they're switching over into this proceeding and to proceed with it.
Well, there is a question, I think, about the impact of an order, particularly in many of these orders, and it's understandable why it happens, because you impact a lot of people, but in many of these orders, these things are mentioned almost in passing, and their true effect becomes apparent later. And here we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, and there really isn't a notice that says to these people, at least in clear terms, here's what we're doing, we're going to apply this new methodology retroactively. I would say that in this docket.
I would say that the MP is out there. It's
that the entire docket of that proceeding, BP, and the BPA proceeding of their ERO12886, they could have looked at that. Looked at that. They knew the issue because they raised the arguments in the refund proceeding in April 25th, 2003, before the orders in this case were ever issued. So, obviously, they knew they had problems with the accounting methodology and the CT 1487 situation. They then failed to proceed with that in the other appeal that's before the Ninth Circuit right now. They then, on this issue, they're coming in trying to collaterally attack it. It's not a It's pure and simple. I would say then that we don't need to focus on the retroactive rate making issue or the or notice or not. This is just a collateral attack situation in which they had their opportunity before the refund proceeding and they failed to progress. Proceed with our argument and now are coming here to have truly a second bite at the apple. Now,
what is your position as to when PG&E had or should have had notice that the commission approve this new methodology?
I would say at least in the refund proceeding, they knew what was going on with the accounting methodology. Furthermore, the out-of-market sales, which were in the dockets ER00555, which is Amendment 23, and the Amendment 33 docket, and also the Southern Cities complaint, which was EL00-11, the commission noted a similar issue of how that the negative imbalance, how the monies would be allocated to the scheduling coordinators who basically caused the load situation and the need for the ISO to make noon calls, out-of-market calls. Now, the EEP is an out-of-market call. It is not. It is something that is not in the real-time imbalance market. It's something extraneous to it. So it's this. They knew that there was PG&E was involved in those proceedings, and PG&E had at least notice of the fact that there was this methodology. This would be employed. That scheduling coordinators who caused this the need for the energy would be the ones who would be allocated the cost. Those orders were back in 2000-2001.
What do you make of the discrepancy between PG&E claiming the damages of $80 to $100 million and then $100 to $200 million later? Do you?
Well, there'd be essentially with the rerun, there'd be a reallocation. There would be some sort of PG&E was getting basically a free ride on earlier in the sense that they were the ones who were needing the load. They were under scheduling, and then under the Charlie adjustment system, the parties that were, when the energy was returned to the ISO, I mean, when the ISO returned the energy to the people.
Everyone paid for it.
Right. Everybody, the other market participants were paying for it, who may or may not have been the ones who caused the energy.
But why in one place does it say 80 to 100 million and in another place it says 100 to 200 million?
I would not know
anything about those numbers?
No, I don't. I mean, the ISO would have an idea of what the rerun calculations would amount to. I will say that in the refund proceeding, they made the claim that it was somewhere around, that there would be a shift of allocation of around $250 million.
Who's they? You mean PG&E?
The PG&E was one of the California parties, and in their request for hearing, they make the argument that the methodology, the accounting methodology switch, would reallocate up to $250 million.
For the whole group.
If you have no other questions, no. I can see the rest of the time.
Thank you, sir. I'll give you 5 minutes.
Your Honor. First, Your Honor, just to address the number discrepancy issues, in the excerpts of record page ER0038, which is attached to PG&E's opening brief, is a copy of the ISO filing in Amendment 51. Where there's a chart that describes the impact of the various changes that were proposed in Amendment 51. And it's the ISO's chart that identifies a market-wide impact of $100 to $200 million. I believe that the $80 to $100 million was an estimate of the impact on PG&E alone. So the ISO was shifting around overall $100 to $200 million in charges, but the impact on PG&E, and note that whenever I say PG&E, I mean PG&E's ratepayers, because all of these costs are passed on to PG&E's ratepayers. So the impact on PG&E's ratepayers is tens of millions of dollars. I don't know the exact amount, but it's tens of millions of dollars, the shift of what they did. I think that Judge Tashima asked an important question, which was slightly different than the questions he asked initially when he said, when did we first learn that FERC was adopting the new methodology? Not when did the ISO first propose it, but when did we first learn that FERC was going to adopt it? And that's an interesting question because in this docket, this order that came out October 17, 2001, where the ISO made its filing, FERC said it was going with the neutrality adjustment charge methodology. That's the methodology we wanted. and docket ER 01-2886. In the December 12, 2002 order that FERC cites in the refund proceeding, paragraph 536, that's at 101 FERC 63026, and again, that's paragraph 536 of a, of, I think it's about an 800-paragraph order, they address this issue. The judge found that the methodology should be used as the methodology as set forth in the energy exchange agreement with BPA in docket number ER 01-2886. Of course, that's wrong. There is no methodology spelled out in the agreement with BPA. It was only spelled out in the cover letter of the filing. But what was adopted by FERC in ER 01-2886 is, as I say below, as it says there, the neutrality adjustment charge method. So it wasn't clear when the judge ruled that we were getting stuck with the wrong method. In fact, he referred back to the order where the right method was used, the right method from our view.
Well, how do you respond to Mr. Lee's comment that he said in your reply brief previously you challenged the methodology, but then you let it drop there and then didn't bring it up in your petition for review? If you're challenging it in that proceeding, but then you don't choose to take it forward, it would certainly seem that you had knowledge of it.
Well, Your Honor, in the refund proceeding, there was an implication in FERC's orders that it was ruling against us, and it suggested it was ruling against us, but then it went on to say that it was adopting the methodology from ER 01-2886. And again, this is the only order that's ever come out in ER 01-2886, and this order refers to no acceptance of any methodology other than the neutrality adjustment charge methodology, which is the one we want. And so, for instance, in the October 16, 2003 order that they reference, and the only place the issue comes up there is footnote 17, FERC says, we clarify that the Commission's prior approval of the ISO's accounting methodology for energy exchange transactions in ER 01-2886 is to be applied to all jurisdictional entities that are similarly situated. But again, we're okay with the methodology that's spelled out in the order that came out in ER 01-2886. So it's never been clear. It's never been clear, and FERC has never been clear, that it was changing the methodology from the neutrality adjustment charge methodology. And quite frankly, the only place it became clear was when finally, in ruling on Tariff Amendment 51, FERC clarified that it was adopting a change in methodology from the neutrality adjustment charge methodology to some other CT-1487. We have no name for the methodology because there's nothing in the tariff that describes it. Look at Section 11.2.9 of the tariff, though, and you'll find the neutrality adjustment charge methodology. It's part of the tariff. It's a default provision that covers charges that don't fit anywhere else, which is exactly what the energy exchange charges are, and that's why that's the provision that was in the tariff at the time the service was taken, and it's the provision that should be applied absent retroactive rate making.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of brief matters. I believe it was Judge Callahan that asked about the authority to pursue this matter. The ISO's assertion of authority is in Section 11.6.3 of the ISO tariff, which authorizes the reruns. If you look at that section, and that appears on page 46 of the appendix, the ISO's initial brief, which is a subject to the motion for judicial notice, that section does not require FERC authority to make refunds. It does not require that there exists a violation of the MMIP, which is what FERC was investigating. I believe the MMIP is the Market Monitoring and Investigation Protocol, although I'd have to check to get the words precisely. In response to...
According to Mr. Lee, I guess you should just go home and adjust the tariffs and see what happens.
Well,
I gather you feel you can't because of this.
I was about to respond to your previous question on that, Your Honor, which is the ISO has not pursued this matter on its own because the Commission instructed us we could not conduct that refund, that rerun. And what the ISO tariff did instead
was... So are they interpreting that tariff when they tell you that you can't do it?
They denied our ability on Amendment 6051. We asked for this invoicing settlement process. We said we were going to use that in connection with 17 reruns under the tariff. not as violations of the MMP, reruns under our tariff, and they said you cannot conduct that ancillary services rerun.
Simple as that. Okay, so if they're telling you that you don't have the authority, then, and we look to, and you're asking to say, well, we do, then what sort of deference are they entitled to in making that determination that you don't have the authority?
They didn't make a determination. They never made that explanation, Your Honor. They never said.
So, well, I guess I'm feeling like it's like I'm arguing with with your children when you say no, and they go, well, what do you mean by no? Well, what? No. I'm hearing you say, well, they told us we can't do it. Well, but they didn't tell you you didn't have authority. They just said you can't do it.
They said we can't do it, and we explained to them why their previous investigation was not relevant to this one, and they just turned around and said, no, we've decided what to investigate. You can't do it. And if you respond
to... It really doesn't get down to whether they have the authority to do that in the context of the enforcement proceeding. You've raised other issues in your brief about reasoned decision-making and so forth. But if they have the authority in the context of an enforcement proceeding to tell you not to enforce it, and that's protected or committed to their discretion under Cheney, then that's probably the end of the argument. And if they don't have the authority, then we proceed.
Your Honor, I would suggest they do not have the authority to tell us we can't do it except by proceeding under Section 206 mm-hmm. of the tariff through their own ability to change our tariff. We, however, were faced with an order that said that, and we pursued that on rehearing and appeal, which I believe is the appropriate methodology to do so.
Okay. Take up your arguments. We haven't talked about this case yet. We may, if we decide to hold any part of it or all of it pending a resolution in the refund or remedy case, we'll let you know promptly, and if not, you can expect something. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for the fine argument from all of you.